My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland.
Do you ever read any Hunter Thompson?
You know, I never have. Somebody I know I should read, but I just haven't gotten around to it.
There are several documentaries that have been made about him.
Yeah.
One of them is kind of up on YouTube in various parts. It's got a very funny sequence in it with him sitting in the passenger seat of a car with Johnny Depp driving it.
Yeah.
And there's another fellow in the ride too, and his name just escaped me, and I'll be busted for it for not remembering. But they're in this car filled with blow up dolls, and they pull up to the camera during this documentary, and then they speed off.
Yeah.
And there's a line uttered somewhere in the midst of that that Thompson says that I've held myself to, where he says, "You buy the ticket. You take the ride."
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the name of his autobiography, isn't it? Buy the ticket, take the ride?
He did several autobiographies. One of them were like the Gonzo paper. There were several Gonzo papers, but the last one that was done about him, the last biography that was done posthumously, called Gonzo, and it was put together by Jan Winter from Rolling Stone.
I told it is a documentary called Buy the Ticket, Take the Ride.
Maybe that was a subtitle to Breakfast with Hunter.
This is Buy the Ticket, Take the Ride, Hunter S. Thompson on film.
Yeah, I'd have to look at that. Yeah. I mean, there's been so much that was done about the guy, but what I appreciated most about what Thompson had done in his life and his career was his thoughts on the fact that you don't really know what it's like to step over the edge until you've been there.
Yeah.
Stand at the edge, look down, and that's close enough. And
no, it's not until you get that "Oh my God, what have I done?" moment.
Yeah, well, which is the basics of his style of writing, and I have kind of refocused a little bit of my thoughts behind Radio Memphis in that aspect.
Oh yeah,
you know, just get out there and get it done. You know,
yeah.
I'm tired of not worrying about pissing people off.
Who have you been worried about pissing off?
I've pissed off a few, but it's sort of like, you know, there's that twinge of, okay, I know if I piss somebody off, I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But there's that, well, did I piss off the right people?
How do you know who the right people to piss off are?
There are people that are associated with what we do over here that I don't want them to be pissed off by. It's like, "Oh my God, Rick, what are you doing?"
Right.
You know, I don't want Diana ringing me up going, "What the hell?" You know, she gets mad because...
Well, she does that on a daily basis any day.
Well, she lost the password to her email, diana@pirateradiostudios.com, the other day.
Oh, no.
So I had to go back into GoDaddy and reset it.
Yeah.
And I texted her. This is like the third time I've done this.
Yeah.
So I always give her some goofy password that'll force her into changing it back to what she can remember.
Right.
So the first one was big boobs. And I sent her the
text.
And
she forgot that?
Well, no, she never changed it, and it just stayed that way, I guess because she liked it. And apparently if I reset it, you have to change it. The other person has to change it within like 30
yeah,
days.
Yeah, when you log in, it'll... Yeah.
You need to go ahead and do that. You know, it's a security thing. So the other day, she calls me. She goes, "I can't get into my email. I didn't change it, so it locked me out." And I said, she goes, "I need a new password." And I said, "All right." So I get in there, and I change it. And I changed it to waffle cunt. And I texted it, because I know she hates that.
Yeah.
And I sent that to her, and she wrote back, "Really? You're an ass."
So that's who you want to piss off in this business?
No, I don't necessarily want to piss I don't want to say what I piss her off, but you know, part of my thoughts too is that, you know, I look at what we've done collectively, you know, as a group around here, and we get copied a lot.
So I haven't even noticed that. But
oh God, yeah, we get copied a lot by other individuals, and to the point where we're flat out ripped off. And I'm not quite sure how I know how to take that. I should be flattered, I suppose.
It's the highest form of it, according to Shakespeare.
But when you look around, and you look around on what's happening on television, on radio, no, there hasn't been an original thought in this business in you know, forever.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, it's like Hollywood movies. There's nothing new coming out.
But I'd like to be able to turn to, you know, I look at our artists that play.
Right.
You know, all the bands that we have on the air. And there's a lot of original thought that's happening.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's not really one band copying another.
No, you know, well... No, that's true, but then
I mean, they're influenced by styles.
No. I don't mean to down our music scene here in Memphis, but there's no clear
down away, my man.
No, there's no clear cohesive scene, so that there's some front runner to emulate. And it's not that there aren't bands that are good enough to be the front runner of a scene, and then nobody would want to count them.
That's not a bad thing.
No,
to say that there's not a front runner is not a bad thing either, because that gives a free rein to everybody to kind of get a shot at it.
But I'm just saying there's no cohesive scene. Like, if you think about the comedy scene in Boston in the 80s, you know, there was a cohesive scene for there to produce a Stephen Wright and to go on a Tonight Show and for everybody to go, oh, we got to try to do what that guy does.
Right.
The scene here is just not cohesive enough to allow for every band in Memphis to think, oh, that band right there, those are the guys at the top of the heap. Because there is no heap.
Should there be a I know there was a stab at it at one point, but should there be a stab at having a union in this town for musicians?
You know, I don't know. You know,
that could get dangerous. That's a slippery slope.
Well, artists, you know, guilds, musicians unions. I mean, I not that I don't believe in those things, but I mean, we're in the South, and just the South is so anti-union, it's not even funny.
Although I did see that the United Auto Workers are coming in.
Are they?
Yes.
Really?
Yes, they're coming into Tennessee because of the, I think it's the Toyota plant.
Yeah, there is a Toyota plant around here, somewhere in there.
And they are wanting to unionize their workers, and of course... they are filing suit against the state of Tennessee, which involves the governor and various senators,
right,
who have been opposed to this. And they're saying, this is a right-to-work state, bitch.
Right.
Which is to understand, those that might be listening outside of the area, a right-to-work state means that they have the right to not let you work.
They have the right to fire you for no reason.
For just, no reason just, at all.
You're off. Yeah. But conversely, now, as I understood, that also means you have the right to walk off the job. I mean, there is a double edge to that. Like,
well, you can always walk off,
but you're not held to, some kind of notification period or anything like that.
I had a job once in Texas, which entailed me working in a shoe store.
Yeah.
And 2 hours into it, I thought, this is bullshit. This is not the no. And so I clocked out for lunch and never went back.
Right.
And I always thought it would be kind of fun to go back about 30 years later. Hey, man, I'm back from lunch. Punch in and go back.
They don't even know who you are.
Yeah, who are you? Because none of those people were there. In fact, I don't think that mall is there.
Well, you know, my dad was an electrical contractor for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, he did construction projects all over the country. And, you know, in the South, of course, in the South, in the electrical industry, you'll find most electricians around here are not union shops. Now, there is there's kind of a non-union union called the Independent Brotherhood of Electrical Workers,
mm-hmm.
and it's for all the non-union shops to, I guess, band together and at least kind of try to fight the unions, but also they do a lot of the same things the unions do.
Yeah.
Job training and all that kind of stuff.
Job training, there's the whole journeyman program, the apprenticeships, right, and that kind of stuff, to make sure they're properly trained.
Right. Now, but I did know a...
pooled insurance.
An electrician around here that was a union guy, and, just he would go months without work, because it's so anti-union here. Now, you go further north,
mm-hmm.
and then, my dad, in fact, in the course of running his business, and not being a union chef, he took a couple projects north of Chicago, and unions ate his lunch. But it's like, if you don't play ball with them, they will tie you up in court so fast it costs you so much money.
Oh, yeah.
And
there's a union for radio people.
Is there?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yes. AFTRA.
I've heard of AFTRA.
Yes, the American Federation of Radio and Television Artists.
Okay, yeah.
And Tennessee has an office in Nashville.
In Nashville, huh?
I know this because I once tried to bring the union into Memphis for radio people. And that would have been monumental had we pulled it off.
Right.
It would have cost me my job had I been successful. It
might have slowed the growth rate of Clear Channel in this market.
Nobody knew that it was me that did it. I was on the phone with them quite extensively. And the nut was that I had to, I had to convince everybody in the city. So which would have meant that all of the radio people in Memphis would have had to have gotten together somehow secretly.
Right.
Imagine getting a bunch of radio jocks in a spot someplace where nobody else knows about this sort of thing, especially when half of them are in management, as it is. And sitting down and coming up with a plan to say, we're going to unionize so we can get fair pay, that they can't just fire us for no particular reason at all. That if they are going to protect their entity, they have to protect us. you know, there's the collective bargaining. That kind of thing.
When they hire you as a personality on the air, do you or do you not have an employment contract that you work on the front end?
Yeah, you are.
Okay.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
And that was standard procedure, and it would be
But there's a little protection for you in an employment contract.
Oh God, no.
There's nothing. They can't just fire you and not give you a severance or something, right?
I mean, no, there were severances built into that. But it was made into their. It was the goodness of their own heart that would make that happen.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when my employment was terminated from Clear Channel, it was to make a long story short. I was under a 2-year contract that had expired for 2 years.
Right.
So in essence, in theory, it went month to month, and there were certain clauses.
Kind of how my lease works, I understand. Kind of. Yeah,
and that the pay would stay the same, you know, as what you were doing. There were bonuses that were paid to you if you hit so many numbers in the ratings and that kind of thing. And should they decide to un-ash you, then it was up to their discretion to give you some type of a severance package, and that was built into whatever the corporate office's policy was. And at one point we heard it was like, for every year you've worked there, they'll give you a month of severance.
That sounds too good to be true.
It was too good to be true. That didn't happen.
Yeah, that never happens.
There was the standard non-compete that was put in there, which meant that I had to stay off of every form of broadcast for 6 months.
Right.
Including the internet. Published and spoken.
They had that covered, huh?
Oh, yeah, they did. Yeah, well, absolutely they did. It was boilerplate stuff.
Just in this market, though, right?
I could leave this market. Yeah, I could go to New Orleans, or I could go to St. Louis or Nashville or whatever.
Right.
And of course, I was all part of the national bloodletting, so a bunch of us were thrown onto the beach real quickly. But it was kind of messed up because they said, well, we're not going to do this. We're not going to do that on the day they fired me. And I said, well, okay, well, you're saying you're not going to do this. Why? And they said, well, because your contract expired 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I said, great, then my non-compete's expired as well. And I went, no, that clause still is in effect.
Uh-huh, yeah, yeah.
And I said, my question at that point, I said, when did my contract become a fucking buffet for you people?
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly the way they treated it. So I wound up hiring an attorney, an entertainment attorney here in Memphis, Charlie, who's been my agent ever since. And he took the bull by the balls. Got me a sweet deal.
Did he?
Got me out of it, yeah.
Yeah.
Instead of 6 months being off the air, they shortened it to 5 months. They were only going to pay me 3 months of severance.
I should pay the 5 if you can't work.
And they made it the entire length of the agreed time.
Yeah.
So 5 months plus there was some talent money that was owed to me that he was able to get.
Oh, good.
So
I might need Charlie's number. Does he specialize in just general employment?
yeah, he does. But here's the thing. You know, when you talk about bringing a union thing into an area, this is a touchy subject for a lot of folks,
right?
Especially when you're talking about entertainment. It's like, why the hell do you need it? You know.
Well, no. I mean, when you talk about a musicians' union, I mean, you know, I know. I think it was on this podcast where I read you the thing that Eric Hughes had put out there about.
It was on the last one you and I did.
Yeah, the restaurant wanting talent to come in for free and for exposure and all that. And I saw another instance of that on the internet. It was on Reddit, but it was up in Vancouver where a restaurant was looking for...
You got one of those?
Yes. restaurant was looking for...
like some type of talent to come play for like a fishbowl or...
For their new restaurant. And, you know, that if it worked out, it might turn into a nightly thing. And,
yeah,
and
they looked
for all kinds of acts. And some musician posted a response to it saying, you know, I'd like to try different cuisine in my kitchen every night. And if you'll come and cook and serve me and my family, you know, we won't pay you or anything, but we'll, you know, we'll definitely give you exposure. And, and that's the thing about musicians, and especially when, you know, the screwed up thing about the business, the only way to make money is what? Album sales and merch. And merch, you're not going to sell unless you're touring, unless you become somebody big enough that you get sought out. So
I'm glad you brought that up because I had a... Go ahead.
So you're not making...
I'm going to get back to it.
You're not necessarily making money from the music, and it's tough enough to make money from performing. But then there's nobody locally that says, all right, you know, for every band that plays somewhere, there needs to be a decent pay for it.
Right.
I mean, you know, and because of that, you've got a lot of bar owners that'll maybe let you play for the door. Then they never pay anybody for entertainment.
No, God, no.
I mean, I think some of the clubs on Beale, obviously, they pay for their... But those are choice gigs in this town. I mean...
Yeah, they are. They are. We know a lot of guys that work those gigs.
Those are tough gigs to get. Once you got it, you don't want to give it up.
You bring up a very good point.
Yeah.
Charlie and I were having this discussion, my agent. And I introduced him to a musician that we both know in the middle of recording a record.
Right.
And we were talking about financial streams for musicians that are making that leap.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To put it into context for those that are listening, the bailiwick, if you will, of Radio Memphis, our music, we play what is called top second-tier artists. Okay?
Okay.
Second-tier being the top local guys. These are the guys that are about to break.
Right.
These are the guys that are about to break big. If the right opportunities come by, the right amount of exposure comes their way. That's this music is tremendous.
Right.
This is
at this point they've got the act down. They've got the music down. It's just
about everything right.
Playing the game to get it out there.
Right.
And even if you've got all that other stuff in place, doesn't mean it'll happen.
Think of it as minor league baseball.
Right.
You're waiting for that call to get the call up. Right. Now, in theory, when you're a top tier artist, you make your money on the road.
Yes.
And record sales is secondary. It used to not be that way.
I think it's been that way for a while because record sales was always you got to pay back the label before you're seeing any of that anyway.
Well, yeah, but do you think let's go back far enough? Let's look at Elvis, at Sun. Okay, he goes into Sun. He drops it. He drops his voice down and his band. They're making some records, right? And they're selling them. Granted, not for much, and you know he's getting a cut. Sam is getting a cut,
right?
And the band's getting their pay out of it, and he's getting some radio play. And he goes out and he plays various shows. Now, those shows back in those days, those tickets were $2 and $3 a pop,
right.
So almost the price of maybe two or three of those singles. The singles, I guess, what was back in the late '50s, early '60s, you could buy a single of 45 for 50 cents, maybe.
Before my time, I guess. That sounds good.
I don't know. We have to bring Doug into this. 25, 30 cents maybe.
Right.
You know?
That
so
sounds
it's,
about
it's,
right.
It's, yeah. It's on par fairly closely. And it used to be that, as I understood it, that a major artist would go on a tour to sell the new record that is being released.
Yeah, like the tour was always kind of the ad for the record or vice versa. I was never really
And obviously he would play all of your favorites.
Right.
But there was going to be a chunk of that show devoted to the new record. That's
right.
Where everybody got up and went to the bathroom or went to go get a beer or whatever.
Well, depending on how the new singles from that album were doing.
Yeah, because you're getting hit with them cold in a party-like atmosphere and you're not right prepared for that, you know.
Right.
But you know, nowadays, when people ask, why we don't pay performance royalty, it's quite simple. Is that an artist, in my estimation, makes their money in the sales of record, recorded material, the sale of merchandise,
right,
and the sale of tickets at a venue.
Yes.
Where all of these things can happen in one spot.
If they can get into a venue where there's going to be, where they're able to actually sell tickets.
Right. And that enters the wrinkle of the venue owner that says, sure, you can play in my place, $400. Out of your pocket.
Oh, paying. I don't think we've got any pay-to-play places here in town.
Bullshit, we don't.
Oh, well, the Daisy.
The Daisy
is
one.
But that's you renting the room for the night.
Newbies.
Yeah, but you're renting that space for
Bullshit. The night. If Mike Glenn from the Daisy on a Saturday night wanted to put a show in there, and let's say you and I had a band.
Yeah.
And we say, hey, we're going to help you put a show in here, and you've got a bar already set up, and we're going to let you take half the door.
Yeah, I shouldn't have to pay you anything for the room.
Then why are you charging me another? They're going to go, well, sound guy, security, and all that stuff. But the sound guy doesn't work for us.
Well, no, I guess I'm not defending. Well, I
want to hear that.
That type of venue, if it wasn't a dive like the Daisy, I mean, like you could go book out Minglewood Hall and do your own event, and they'd staff you. You're going to pay them to do it. They're going to staff it. But, it's up to you to promote and get people in there. I mean, I don't have a problem with a venue you can book to do that kind of thing. But that, obviously that shouldn't be the way of things, and that doesn't excuse all these other club owners that don't pay anything at all. Well, and it's such a tough scene, man.
It is tough, and that's why I want to hear your take on it, because you're a working musician.
Sort of. I'm a musician.
But for those of us that are sitting here right now,
right,
you've done it, I have not.
Right, okay. Well, and so, here's the deal. You've got your average bar in Memphis, and I'm not knocking these places, something like P&H Buccaneer or these kind of midtowny dive bars that are really popular, but part of the reason they're popular and you're going to play to an audience there is because they don't charge a cover or they don't pay their bands. It's a dive. It's hard to get in there and you can go there and play those gigs and they'll let you have the door, and at least they'll let you have that. They're not charging you to play there.
unless you bring in two or three guys or two or three bands. So
right.
Let's say, you know, one of the last shows I went there to see, pardon me, Star and Micey.
Yeah.
Fantastic guys.
Right.
Great act. They were fourth on a four band bill.
Yeah. Well, now, see, here's
$7 to get in.
And then
at the Buccaneer.
And then they figured out how they're going to split the door.
I guess. I don't know. Maybe part of that was back to the place. I don't know.
I've been in a situation where we got double booked at a gig where we had lined up two other bands to play with us, and whoever booked the place had inadvertently already booked another band for that night. So one of the bands we were playing with said, no, we're out. We don't want to do it. And then it became the two acts that we had plans to play there with this out of town act, and it was, you know, so we just shared the show with them, and we split the door. What much of a door to speak of, but
see, that's the problem. Yeah, there's three of you on there, and all of a sudden that split gets mighty thin.
Yeah, well,
and then there's sound. Then you got to pay the poor schlub that's running the board.
You got a place like P&H where they don't have a cover. You go in there and play. You go in there and play. You book it, play. You could, I think, you can charge for the door if you want, but. I tell you where it gets tricky in this town and in this scene, and I don't know if it's like this anywhere else. And I've kind of complained about this sometimes because I'm getting old. But the Midtown scene, like, nothing gets started till 10 o'clock at night. Like, if there's a band playing in a bar around here, except for maybe here in Cooper Young, where things do tend to start a little earlier because they've got more traffic
around 9-ish.
Yeah,
but still.
You know, bands don't crank up till 10:30.
And the headliner's not going to have the stage till near midnight.
And
now,
well, this is where you get into a weird situation that I wonder if they have this in other cities. I've never heard of this anywhere else before, but I've seen this happen with other shows. I've played shows like this where one band is the headliner. They're technically top of the bill, right? And there's two bands before, one or two bands before. Let's say there's two bands before them, because with two bands, if it's just two bands on the bill, it's not a big deal.
Right.
But with three bands on the bill, and this band's technically the headliner, so their name's at the top, they're supposed to go last. But
right.
Because the show doesn't start till 10:30, and everybody knows that by the time the third band goes on at 1, the crowd's
and
not,
you're all playing an hour set,
yeah,
or 45
yeah,
minutes plus 45 a 15
minutes to an
minute swap out.
So after that, by the time the third band goes up, that crowd's gone. So the headlining band will say, we're taking second position. We're going second. We're going to have the opener.
Oh, yeah. It happens all the time here.
We're going to have the opener, and then the second opener gets the shit, the night shift, the shit gig.
Yeah.
And so, then technically, I've been the band that got on the back end of that. I was like, well, technically, I guess that means we're headlining then. We're going last, right? But then everybody leaves.
after the middle act comes in, and then you're done.
And, you know, I've wondered why we don't have any clubs in this town or bars in this town that don't start sooner. They do on Beale Street because they've got the tourists to appeal to.
It's built in.
But you know, the Buccaneer actually does an early show and a late show, so that's smart. They'll do an 8 o'clock show, and then they'll do a 10 o'clock show.
So the bands are on the hook for both, or
no? They'll have
two
three different acts for one for the 8 o'clock show and another two different acts for the late show. Yeah,
well, that is smart.
But
yeah.
You know, of course, that place is just you gotta
it's a living room.
Yeah, you gotta want to hang out
someone's house.
There. But if we had a decent venue that actually said like a high tone, like it used to be, it said, look, we're gonna have a show at 8 or 7 or 8 for the folks who want to get early. We're gonna have a late show late. Two different shows. Comedy clubs do it. I mean,
Saturday night 7:30.
Yeah.
You put three acts on that bill.
I think you'd get more people out who, you know, again, guys like me that used to be, I'll stay till 3 in the morning, hang out at the high tone,
sure,
and get shit-faced. But have since gotten married, had kids, moved on. They'd come out and hear live music if they didn't have to do it at 10 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think that's one of those things that just, I think that limits a band's ability to get exposure. Because if you can't, because there is a certain segment of the population you just can't get in front of at a bar at 10 o'clock at night. You know, unless you get into some of these daytime festivals, you're not going to get exposed to that crowd of folks that just don't go out to bars.
You bring up a good point, too, back to the early times and late times. You think about it, if a band was smart, and I'm not saying that there are that many that are, they get on to the 7:30 or 8 o'clock show.
Right.
They're done by 10 o'clock.
Yep.
If they're smart, they book a late night
gig somewhere else.
They're double dipping somewhere in the city.
Right. Well, again, I look at comedians. They do that shit all the time.
My
in
God,
a city
yes.
like New York, you hear about comics all the time. They go do 15 minutes, hop in a cab, go across town, do another 15 minutes somewhere else.
They'll hit four or five joints
right.
because the sets are so short. Vegas was the king of that.
Yeah.
Because you would have shows that would start as, I guess the earliest comedy show would technically be about 10 o'clock in Vegas. Now,
right.
Vegas is a different world. But there'd be shows at 10, midnight, 2, and 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
There was a 4 a.m. show.
That's crazy.
But that...
And it would wrap up at 5:30, yeah. You know, for a bunch of comedians, you know, and you'd have like 7 or 8 guys that are up there, maybe not that quite, maybe 3 or 4 guys in the late show.
But yeah, you're right. A band could actually double book a night if they're ambitious enough to do it. But the problem is now, well, again, the only clubs that I know that start music early are on Beale. Like if you talk to Ashley Bishop from Delta Crush,
you're right.
They're done playing by 10 o'clock. You know,
right?
It's, you know, because they get out there and they're making enough money that there's no reason for them to go off to another gig that night. But that's Beale Street, and that phenomenon in Memphis only happens on Beale Street.
Yeah, because Beale has a higher cover.
You got foot traffic just out the butt, man. You've got people walking by,
right? And so the tips are going to naturally be a little higher. You got tourists.
I mean, again, I think that's why Cooper Young starts a little bit earlier than everywhere else.
Ooh, Hilda, was ist das? Und der Blues, you know?
Yeah. but again, most of these other clubs in Midtown in particular, but even at Stagestop, we try to start the Radio Memphis shows at what? 8?
About no,
8:30, 8:30, 9 o'clock?
Okay. Doors at 8, shows at 9.
That's right. So yeah.
And that's 3 bands, and they're all going to play 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And then the last guy gets on the stage, well, so it's 9, 10. See, he's on the stage by 11.
So we're usually done there by 1 o'clock, like packed up.
Right,
ready
because
to go. That's not too
it's
bad.
Not a 15-minute turnover on the stage either because
oh, no.
You got to strike it completely and then rebuild it. And they always, I love this, 15 minutes. Okay, half hour, we'll be back, you know. And that's kind of what drags it out. And it's nobody's fault there. I mean, that's just the logistics of it.
And, you know, man, I'm going to take a lot of heat from our fellow musicians. But, you know, bands can work together to get around that, too. I mean, we've played a show.
Shared backlines?
Yeah, well, just either share backline or, hey, let's all get there before the show starts. And you guys can set your amps. And we'll set our amps in front of y'all since we're going first. You just leave your amps on stage. We'll just get our crap and move. And then you guys are cut down on that time. If the stage is big enough, which...
And when it comes down to broadcasting the damn show live, I love that. Give me enough time to run my spots, and boom, we're back.
Yeah, you yeah.
Know? That's oh, I love that.
It's just, if you get everybody on the same page, let's all get there way before the doors open, let everybody bring their stuff in, try to stack what we can.
Yeah.
Again, you got to have a stage big enough to do it. Now, I mean, there's places in this town where you barely have a stage for a band. So
Hard Rock.
Yeah, that's a tight little stage. But
the green room, which is actually green.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not even big enough to change your mind in.
No, it's not. It's barely enough room for two people to sit while one tunes a guitar.
Because there's a stairway that runs right through the...
Well, it's barely a green room. It's like was that stage originally part of the plans to that place?
That building was originally a recording studio.
Well, you know, that's the first Hard Rock that they've ever had a live venue at. I know they have it at other
really?
Ones now. Memphis was the very first Hard Rock to have a performance space.
And to think they were going to close it. Now they're moving it.
Oh, are they?
Yeah, they're moving it.
Where to?
You're going to love this.
Yeah?
It's on Beale, but...
Elvis's old place.
EP's, East of Second.
So they'll be off Beale.
Excuse me, West of Second.
They'll be off the...
Across from Blue City, George Paul's Last Call. Where the Elvis statue is there at MLGW.
Yeah.
They're going to go into that, and that's a big room. And I've been in there when there were bands playing. And it's a great sounding room, and it's a big place, beautiful place.
Well, that's what they did, because I mean, that place they've got now, the stage is not the best.
And why they're doing this?
Are terrible.
You know, Julian Sally, the GM here at the Hard Rock Memphis, he can call me up and bitch out if he wants, and he would probably laugh at me saying this. But I believe why they're doing this is to get away from the SS group that runs security.
Be right outside it, yeah.
They'll be out of it because they're trying to attract an all ages group.
Yeah, and you can't get that.
It's
on
a family friendly environment. Hard Rock is always has been, and I love the Hard Rock. I absolutely love that place.
Yeah,
the food
yeah.
is wonderful. The staff has always been more than gracious to us.
Absolutely.
And what they want to do is get away from the fact that when it's 9 p.m., you've got, you know,
nowhere family friendly on downtown.
You got the hobnailed boot running the damn street down there, and I go, oh, you're not 18? Get the hell off the street. And then by 10, you're not 21? Go away.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they're running people through metal detectors. They're frisking them. And they're trying to, like, come down and have a burger and see their kid play down at the Hard Rock.
Well, you know, that's one of those things, like...
it's bullshit.
It's like airport security. It sucks that they have to do it. It also sucks when it's not effective, because we've been down there doing an event when shots just...
Oh,
somebody
yeah.
started popping off shots.
Oh, yeah. I saw a stampede run right through the Hard Rock Cafe.
Right, and so it's you know, I'm of two minds on it. I think it sucks that we have to have that level of security just to walk onto Beale Street.
And it sucks that they have to move it.
Well, especially when you think about Bourbon Street. They don't have that shit, and they've got strip clubs and every vice you could possibly want on Bourbon Street.
That's the problem. There's not enough titty down on Beale.
That might be very well be the problem.
They should have taken Jerry Lee Lewis's place. You know, the old Pat O'Brien's. Yeah. And they should have turned that into this big Mondo Memphis
cabaret
titty bar down there with walk me downs and divers out of there.
Yeah.
$20 cover. Make it high as hell to get in there.
See, the Bible contention will never allow that in the city of Memphis, not in downtown Memphis. It'll never happen.
Well, you know, they used to run whores down there all the time back in the 30s and the 40s.
So. Oh, I know. You know, one of my favorite places to play is Ernestine and Hazel's. Mm-hmm. It's, you know...
The old whorehouse.
The old whorehouse. I mean, they've still got all the rooms upstairs and...
Still smells like a fish cannery in there.
Quite a historied place, man.
that it is. Yeah, I mean, there are too many people around here that want to rewrite the history, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they changed the... I used to live on Mud Island, and the bridge that you would go over... Where the Coast Guard station is.
Right.
Auction Street Bridge.
Yeah.
It's not the Auction Street Bridge anymore.
What is it?
It's the Willis Bridge. They renamed it.
After the barbecue joint?
G.W. Willis? J.W. Willis?
I don't know.
I think it's the Willis Street. Anyway, they've renamed it.
Yeah.
It's always been known to me as the Auction Street Bridge. You know why they changed it? Because somebody got under their ass that's where they thought that's back in the day, that's where they were auctioning off Negro slaves.
Oh, was this in the middle of all those parks changing their names?
Oh, too? It was way before that.
Was it?
About 3 to 4. Well, it was on the, you know, it was the lead up to that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact of the matter was they were actually auctioning cotton down there and soybean and whatever crops that were growing.
Yeah. All the slave auctions were going on in Nathan Bedford Forest Park.
That's exactly right. That's right. Right there where the Office Depot is. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's where that is. Yeah. So they renamed Auction Street as a result of that. So it's a rewriting of history.
Man, may as well rename the Cotton Museum. We don't talk about cotton.
Talk about cotton. No, that's a bad scene. But see that points back to the history of what has been this area. You had black musicians that came up and down the river,
right,
and stopped here. To become a part of the scene.
Right.
Elvis Presley used to sneak down to Beale before he even had recorded, and he would go to where Alfred's is now, right? Alfred's used to be a different club.
Yeah.
And there was a back stairwell.
God, I can't remember it being anything other than Alfred's.
I know. Imagine that. Well, at the time, and this is a great... Yeah, please. Thank you. Alfred's has a... on the east side of that building, which is now above Wet Willie's,
right,
there is this there's a stairwell, a back stairwell, and mm-hmm. we used to use that as an employee entrance all the time. And there was a great story that I heard. I don't know how true this is, but I want to believe that it is true because I think it's right. That Elvis, when he was about 16, I guess 15, 16,
yeah,
he used to sneak down to Beale Street from what I guess would be George W. Lee Road.
Right.
Where the FedEx Forum is now.
Yeah.
And he would come up those back stairs, and there was a hotel up there where the radio station was. In fact, Little Richard lived in the old control room for Rock 103.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was actually his bedroom, which is really bizarre. And then, of course, they ran us out of there. But anyway, Elvis would often hang out by that door and listen to the piano. Because there was always a piano player in a whorehouse or in a flop house or in some honky-tonk, and there were tons of them down up and down Beale at that time. A bouncer came out that door to throw a guy out and hit Elvis in the head with the door. Didn't hurt him or anything, but
right.
It startled him. And here's this kid, you know.
It startled the bouncer more than
he's like, whoa, yo, Whitey, what you doing here?
Yeah.
And he's like, man, I'm just here for the music, you know. And he says, nuh-uh, you ain't here for nothing. And they grabbed him and threw him off of that second floor landing.
Damn. So they weren't
playing around. Him off. But, yeah, Elvis was very deeply moved by that music down there that was existing at that time. So you have to think that would be mid-40s, early 40s.
And it was a pretty lively place, Beale Street was, point.
Oh,
yeah.
Lord, yeah. So here he was kind of caught up into that scene and listening to that. And, you know, there was that whole vibe that there were musicians like you know, all those cats that came up from North Mississippi.
Oh, yeah.
And then the guys that were coming down the river on their way to New Orleans, the guys that are coming out of Chicago and St. Louis.
Let's see what, I mean.
Now, Handy. Well, we learned an awful lot about what WC did.
Oh, yeah. Well, see, I've got, so, when I was growing up, and I mean, this is the 80s, I was 16, and I guess 89? About when me and my friends all turned 16, you know?
And Beal wasn't a thing yet, was it?
But Beal was there, but, you know, and there were the jukes, and there were the bars, the clubs, and the music, some street musicians, but I mean, you didn't have Peabody Place down there. It was all...
Oh, God, no.
It was all, like, industrial. It was all, like, warehouses and stuff that
at night
was just nothing going on. So Beal itself was kind of like this island of light in a sea of darkness. You know, you left Beal, you're just kind of going out and, you know...
Were there clubs and stuff down there?
Yeah, there were clubs on Beal, but everything outside of Beal. You know, that two-block stretch of Beal where everything is now?
Yeah, from second
that
to...
used to be
second
it.
To fourth, yeah.
That used to be it. Everything else down there was industrial, commercial, MLG&W was down there, and it was pretty crime-ridden. You didn't, you know, they used to say you're taking your life in your own hands if you go wandering downtown off Beal.
Was it advertised as like a tourist spot?
Yeah, I don't know that it was. The tourism,
I mean,
just
before Performer got a hold of it?
Yeah, this, you know, tour Harrington, when he came in, he's the one that really cleaned all that up and built Peabody Place and brought in Performer, brought in tried to turn it into a tourist spot. But we would go down on Friday nights after, I mean, I played high school football, but
right,
we go play a football game and we pile into somebody's car and drive down to Beale Street and go listen to street musicians. We couldn't get in any of the bars, and our parents would have, I know my parents would have kicked my ass if they'd known I was sneaking into Beale. I mean, at the time, it was just a dangerous place for a 16-year-old white boy to be wandering down to.
I grew up in San Antonio. I used to go to the Riverwalk. I understand, you know.
But you know, I mean, we kept doing it because of the music, man. I mean, it's just go listen to those guys play. You go stand outside a bar you couldn't get in and listen to the music.
Because they were loud enough, and they would always leave the doors open.
Well, and eventually we got a little bit older and got a little bit more... crafty, you know, you learn
talk your way in.
No, not even that. I don't think we ever really got any of the places, but we did learn the fine art of finding the right individual to, you know, like slide a $10 bill to, get him to buy you some beer, and you know.
I gotcha. Now, were there a lot of street musicians down there at the time?
Yes.
Like around the park, or like, I guess not. The park wasn't there, but you know, in between the buildings and the alleyways.
Well, yeah, no, I think Handy Park was still. I mean, that
was vacant.
That area was there, and they would play there. And there was a gazebo down on the east end of Beale, right by where the New Daisy is. I think the gazebo is still there. There was a guy. He used to play his beat up old red Stratocaster.
Right there, fourth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had a Fender amp and a shopping cart, a Fender Twin Reverb and a shopping cart, and he'd wheel it down to that gazebo, he'd plug it in, and break out this busted up old red Stratocaster and play the ever-living shit out of it. And Tora Tora, when they did their first album, he plays the intro in Walking Shoes. That's the guy they got to do that.
Really?
Yeah, because he was an old Bill Street.
He was, just today I was playing that song, yeah.
Yeah, he would just sit there in old denim coveralls. And a fedora and play the shit on the guitar. And that's that. I guess that was they're trying to bring some of that Memphis, that Beale Street heritage into that album, but they had him do that.
Because he finger picks it, you can hear it. Yep. That is awesome.
Yeah. And he was just a fixture down there. I'm sure he's passed on, but he was ancient back then. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the one thing about Beale, even though today it's so Disneyland. At least they're trying to turn it that way. The musicians are still down there.
I don't think they know what they want to do with Beale. That's part of the problem.
Well, now that they've kicked Performer out of there and the city has now taken it over, it makes you, it gives one pause to think about why city government is now getting involved in the actual bar business. But I can, you know, I can see why they would. If they're going to go that way with it, you they might as well go ahead and go balls deep and open up a titty joint down there. I'm with you on that.
Well, you know, I mean, I know.
Why not?
Shay Flynn used to argue for us needing a red light district, but you know, and I'm not, you know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm for titties because I love titties, but
who doesn't?
I mean, I don't care. I'm not hung up on the morality of the issue, but you know, there's no way to open up a strip club in the city right now anyway because of the county ordinance. But if you had to put one anywhere, put it on Beale. Berman does it.
I thought of a plan. You take an old shopping mall.
Yeah.
Oak Court's about there. It's already got the parking area and all that. You turn that into your whole deal. You've got bars, and you got titties, and you got naked people, and you got maybe, hell, throw in some whoring and some gambling while you're at it. But it's contained in one area. You pay $50 to park your car. You pay another $50 to get in. The city makes all that money.
And then it's just the Sodom and Gomorrah from there. Huh?
And then just if you're dumb enough to pay $9 for a PBR, then that's on you. If you're dumb enough to pay $100 for a hand job under the table, that's on you. It could be a calloused hand for all you know.
Ooh.
But see, another idea we had was like an old strip center, pardon the pun, where it's fenced off, and then so all the cops are like hanging there. You put a police substation in there. Half of the cops are working those clubs anyway.
Did you ever watch The Wire on HBO?
I've seen parts of it. I was kind of into it, but it wasn't enough for me to hold me.
I want
to
say it was season 3. There was one of the deputy chiefs who it's about the cops in Baltimore, and this they all have different districts. And they're under all this extreme pressure to get their stats down, their crime rates down.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you realize that show is so realistic. One of the things that some of the other district commanders would do was they would, they'd bust like felonies down to misdemeanors so that when they're reporting their crime stats, there weren't that many, aggravated assault. There was a lot of aggravated assaults, but no attempted murders,
Gotcha.
But this one guy he went to all the drug dealers and said, here's the deal. See these projects right here?
Right.
Like these old abandoned projects, they're yours. You do whatever you want in them.
Mm.
And the police would stand out on the edge of it, and they wouldn't bust any of us. They'd go in there and buy the drugs and do whatever, and his crime statistics start going down. But then, of course, you've got a police official basically sanctioning...
Right.
Sanctioning an area where crime is legal.
But I see why he's doing it.
And they called it Hamsterdam. That's what they call it.
Hamsterdam.
Hamsterdam. But you're watching that show, you're going... That would totally work. That makes so much sense. Yeah, and then the crime goes down because the people aren't even, they're all right there. Everybody knows what they are.
Sure.
The drug dealers aren't ripping each other off. It's,
you got to clean out the occasional OD.
Yeah.
Maybe a girl stabbed some guy because he was short on the money, to pay for the blowjob, whatever the hell.
Of course, on the show, this ended this guy's law enforcement career because, when it came out.
How sad. They should have a statue erected in his honor.
Your stats so low. What are you doing?
Well, we just went through that here in Memphis. That whole, I don't follow too much local news. I do watch it on TV. It's far too depressing. But that whole thing about one of the officers, an underling, had accused the chief, Tony Armstrong, of altering the numbers to show a lower crime stat.
Oh, I'm sure they do it.
And this guy came
out and said,
this guy's full of shit. This ain't happening. He was ready to file suit against the city, file suit against the police department. It was this big deal.
Yeah.
And then overnight, it went away.
Oh, yeah.
And it was like, these two guys have shook hands and made friends, and they actually had a press conference where they shook hands and made friends. I'm like, somebody paid somebody to shut fuck up
I think it goes beyond that. It's not even this. They probably just let that guy peek behind the curtain. I mean, this is how the whole machine works. We have to live. I mean, even on that show, The Wire, they point out, that fudging the statistics to get the rates down, the DA's office is involved in that. You can't just knock major crimes down to smaller crimes and kick the criminal loose unless you got collusion there. But that's how they, if nobody was really hurt, let's
just go ahead and, knock it down.
Yeah.
You remember the other night we were at the Phoenix for the blues thing with Joanne Fish?
Yeah.
And Eric Hughes and the trio... The Eric Hughes Trio were up on stage, and they were, of course, there was a tribute to W.C. Handy.
Great.
And he did the song Mr. Crump's Blues.
Right.
And that song was, he tells the story about how it was a political song.
Right.
And I love how Eric tells the story.
Yeah, I wish I had a recording. Oh, I guess they filmed that, didn't they?
They did, yeah. It'll be on the documentary. But I love how he said that it was sort of a joke. It was a practical joke that was played on Crump himself, and Crump used it.
Yeah,
Mr. Crump don't want none of this down on Beale no more. He don't want no whoring. He don't want no more drinking. He doesn't want no gambling.
What is it they said
he was going to clean up Beale.
Well, for a while there, he was letting Beale go. In fact, he refused to enforce prohibition.
Yeah,
but then I guess there came a sea change and decided he had to clean it all up.
The churches that were just east of there, they're not going to have no puking and stuff in their hedges and on their sidewalks, and they have to come in on Sunday morning because there's a bunch of drunks that have been out there all night and they're asleep on the steps.
Yeah.
They don't want that. Mr. Crump, you got to get rid of these people. And so he's like, yeah, I'll clean up Beale. And so Handy writes the song. And
as a parody, and it became Crump's campaign slogan. It's our campaign song, right?
Mr. Crump.
Awesome. Can you imagine? And again, I think... The biggest difference between Memphis and New Orleans, and there's a lot, obviously. Culturally, though, I think we have a lot more in common with New Orleans than a lot of other cities in the country.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, you're right, yeah.
You know, there's no other city that I think compares, can compare, at least, like, we not saying we're in New Orleans, but, you know. But I think the biggest difference is you've got, you know, I don't know, maybe it's that, it's religious is what it comes down to. Because here you've got the Bible, but you've got the Baptists.
But it's religious in New Orleans, too.
Yeah, but here's the difference. In New Orleans, it's a Catholic religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's Mardi Gras. It's you can do whatever the hell you want as long as you repent, and you quit doing something for a month.
Fat Tuesday ends at midnight,
yeah.
You know, and then it's Lent.
I mean, you know, it's a little bit more of a permissive religious culture there than there is here.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Because Baptists don't want you to have any fun.
No, in fact, just not long ago, all the Paulist Catholics left Memphis.
Well, what is Paulist? What does it mean?
They study the teachings of Paul.
Oh, okay.
So therefore, they're Paulists. And like a Jesuit is one who teaches the writings, not the writings, but the words of Jesus.
Right.
And a Paulist, talks about Paul. But yeah, this used to be a very interesting place for the Paulist group of priests that lived in Memphis, and now they've all unasked it.
Huh.
Because Paul doesn't cotton to any blues or horn or whatnot, at least not in public.
Yeah.
You know. But New Orleans, yeah, with the voodoo community, is based in Catholicism.
Well, it's such a melting pot there, too.
Oh, my God, yeah. Yes. I mean, there's Caribbean, there's African, there's French, there's white man, there's...
South American influences out the butt.
And there's Native American influences, everything going on. Hell, the Irish built the original levee system under slave labor. From people that had brought the Irish over, promising them jobs. And when they got off the boat, they went, yeah, we got a job for you. Indentured servitude.
Yep.
And those levees stood until Katrina knocked them down. Those exact levees.
That's right.
All that time. So finally the Irish got their revenge on New Orleans. I tease my wife about it because she's an off-the-boat immigrant. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I say we have more in common with them just like culturally. You know, as far as being part of the Southern music culture, you know.
Now, where do you think St. Louis falls into this? Because we talked about this the other night.
You know, St. Louis, you know, I don't want to piss off our St. Louis listeners.
I don't either. But I like St. Louis. It's a fine city.
I mean, maybe because I'm from Memphis, I just don't associate St. Louis with musical heritage, musical history, and I'm not saying that there isn't any there.
But Handy wrote the song St. Louis Blues.
Well, Handy wrote the song there, and obviously, I mean, St. Louis...
And that was the hit. It was a bigger hit than Memphis Blues.
I mean, look, if you're coming up from the Delta, you might start in New Orleans. You'd probably end up in Memphis.
Along the way, there's Jackson and Vicksburg.
Along the way is Jackson, Vicksburg, but eventually all these guys filtered up to Chicago, and St. Louis is on the way.
In Kansas City.
And then from there, it was, you know, New York or L.A. or the world or just there in Chicago.
Cleveland.
So, yeah. Well, Cleveland's a whole nother story. Now, I think St. Louis has more blues cred than Cleveland's got rock cred, just because Humphrey said it there.
Absolutely. And those of you who live in Cleveland, fuck you. Fuck every one of you. The only reason why the only reason why Cleveland got to be the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was Alan Freed.
Well,
that and Huey Lewis.
Well, that and I think
the heart of rock and roll.
I think there's. I mean, you know as well as I do. It was Memphis. It was Cleveland. I think there's one other city all vying for the damn Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to be there.
Detroit? Was it? No, it wouldn't be Detroit.
It might. I don't know. Who knows? But I think. Well, every Memphian, every, you know, God-fearing Memphian believes that, you know, it was our right, our birthright to have the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame here, and we were robbed by that by Cleveland. But, you know, it's just like getting an NFL team. Obviously, our team of business people and politicians that were trying to throw the money at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame to bring it here, they just didn't play the game as well as Cleveland. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't know that it came down to, it's just because of Alan Freed, and that trumps everything that happened in Memphis. I think it was whatever backroom deals got made.
It was political at the time. You know, when there were, I guess it was about probably now about 15 years ago when Père Lachaise, the cemetery that is in Paris where Jim Morrison is buried, his lease ran up on his grave.
I know your lease could run up on a grave.
Well, there apparently you lease a grave.
They got enough dead people in Paris.
I guess so, and they have to have a place to put them. But a lot of it was that the Parisian government was a little pissed off with dealing with American hippies that were putting up, you know, all the graffiti, and they were leaving cigarette butts and bottles of Jameson's laying around and Bushmills and stuff. So they had actually actively sought. They went to the Morrison family and said, "Look, we haven't dealt with this in a long time."
Yeah.
But Jim's lease is coming up, and we're thinking we're not going to renew it. Now, what are you going to do about the body?
Yeah.
Immediately, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland said, you can bury him here. Now, can you imagine for just a moment what it would have been like, what news media frenzy would have been had they dug up Jim Morrison from Paris and carried his bones to Cleveland, Ohio?
I can't. Well, first of all, I can't think Jim himself would have appreciated that.
No.
And all the Morrison fans would have flipped out.
Ray Manzarek would have had a fit.
Yeah. Cleveland. You know, I've never been to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland.
Me neither.
I know Doc's going, isn't he?
The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductions this year are not in Cleveland.
Oh, they're in New York or something?
They're in New York because of Kiss, which that whole scene.
Well, nobody has as much juice as Gene.
So, yeah, that's in Brooklyn this year.
Huh.
So why don't they have an induction ceremony here? See?
You know, I don't know. I mean,
we have a Memphis Musicians Hall of Fame here.
Yeah.
Which we just went through the whole.
Well, you know, Gibson's got that whole Rock and Soul museum,
which is used to be curated by the Smithsonian.
Yeah, is that even open anymore?
Rock and Soul?
Yeah,
it's not at the Gibson anymore. It's over in the FedEx Forum.
Oh, okay. So
but it's still there. Yeah, there's some neat stuff. I was there when it first.
Yeah, it was a neat little. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, and that's the thing.
But see, all the good stuff was taken to Cleveland.
Well, there's so much more musical heritage in any given block of downtown Memphis than there is in the entire city of Cleveland. Now, I'm not to take away from Alan Freed's legacy. You know, obviously, it,
rock and roll. He put two words together.
Well, it isn't that.
He ripped that off.
He had a popular show. He was good at.
It was a radio guy who ripped it off from somebody else.
Yeah, oh, probably. Yeah,
it's what we all do.
But his show was quite popular. He was able to integrate their airwaves in some ways, and he was kind of the first shock jock, if you think about it, as tame as he was.
Good point.
I know by today's standards he's no Howard Stern, but if you were a mom or a dad in the 50s, I don't know.
Oh, you didn't want your
devil.
Kid to, oh God, no.
Yeah.
Well, rock and roll was the problem.
Yeah.
There were cities in the United States that actually banned the performance of rock and roll music. There was a long time conspiracy theory, and I've actually researched a lot of this, and there's some thought to this that's been put into this, and there may be some truth to this. Elvis was drafted into the army,
right,
to make him go away. The charges were brought up on Jerry Lee Lewis
to make him go away.
And of course, one theory that I heard was that Little Richard was found Jesus to make him go away, but I don't buy that one.
Well, everything I've heard about Little Richard's career is he. It was more luck than talent. Not that he wasn't talented, but just...
I met him once.
Well, and you know, I mean, when you're talking about the old Rock 103 control room being in his bedroom, my first thought was, can you imagine how many men lost their virtue in that room?
And see, I was at the one of the greatest rooms in this town, the Gibson Guitar Lounge,
right,
back when it was open. And right now, they've just got sheets laying over everything. Everything is still there.
Yeah.
Hadn't been open in years.
A great room.
And I was in there for a tribute to Jerry Lee Lewis. And Little Richard was there.
Right.
And there was all these other bands that were playing. And I went to go shake the dew off my lily, if you will. And I went into the men's room. And it was kind of a dead part of the night. There really wasn't that many people there. And I went in. And I was done my deal there. And I was washing my hands. And the door kicks open. And there's a very, very large black man wearing a black suit and black glasses, black shirt and black tie.
Yeah.
I said, man, he looked like... You know, he could screw you up.
Yeah.
And he looked around the room, and he looked at me, and he kind of gave me that, hey, what's up? And he held the door open, and Little Richard walked in.
Nice.
And Richard looked at me, and he goes, well, hello there. And I was conflicted for a moment, because here it was. Here's one of the fathers of rock and roll.
Yeah.
He's like the Ben Franklin of rock and roll.
Right.
There at the beginning, created some important documents, had a very, you know, very keen sense of what it was like in this business.
And now he thinks Rick Cheddar is attractive.
And I'm in the men's room, and there's a very large man holding the door,
yeah,
which is now closing, and Little Richard is there, who has me cornered.
Were you feeling like a little uncomfortable? Like a chicken in a rotisserie?
In a way, yes. but you know, I kid, I exaggerate a little bit of that. But for the most part, it was... You know, he was very nice. He wanted to know who I was.
Yeah.
where I came from, and I told him that I was at Rock 103 at the time, and he goes, oh, I know what you're talking about. I said, really? And I said, yeah, we're up on the second floor. And he goes, and you're just one room off of Beale, you know, toward the south. And I said, why, yes, as a matter of fact. And he goes, that was my bedroom.
That's awesome. But think about him, though, to be a homosexual black man at that time. Mm. And as flamboyant as he was, to have everybody convinced that that's just part of the act.
Sure. Tutti frutti.
You know, for his career, you know, that there was a time that there was a time people would have killed his ass just for being gay. I mean,
oh yeah.
I mean, thank God that didn't happen, because I think his contribution is huge.
It's enormous.
Absolutely
enormous. I would put him up there with Chuck Berry in a heartbeat.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely.
Jerry Lee Lewis. That's why he was there. And I said, I said, are you tight with Jerry Lee? I mean, after all these years,
right?
You guys still talk? And he goes, I wouldn't talk to that honky bastard if I had to. And he was swishing and sashaying and all this other stuff. But no, it was a very brief encounter, and I make light of it over the years. But it was, to me, it was kind of important, because that's one of the icons. Like I said, he's the Ben Franklin of rock and roll.
It really is one of the icons, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and it's funny how those old guys, I mean, didn't get, you know, the money, frankly, that they deserve.
Oh, Jerry Lee Lewis is still working.
Yeah, yeah. None of those guys got to. Nobody knew what the hell they were doing when they signed those deals. And
when I met him, it's the same patterned line over and over with him. It's like, hey, killer. He calls everybody killer. And he shakes your hand, but he looks behind you.
Yeah.
He's looking at the next guy behind you who he's got to deal with.
Right.
You know, and then he's got that gentle pull, the politician pull.
Yeah.
Shakes your hand, pulls you to get you out of the way.
Huh.
And he expects that little pat on the back, on the little shoulder, thank you, killer. And then he's like, oh, man. And that's all there is to it.
And that's just what he's used to, I guess.
That's what he's used to.
Now, can you imagine being Paul McCartney and having, like, the guy has no concept of what it's like to just interact with people on a normal level.
You
can't possibly. I mean,
when you're thrust into the business at 15, 16 years of age.
To think about the perspective of being a Beatle, not just us in the business at 15 or 16 years of age, but to somehow achieve godhood in that.
You literally changed the world.
Literally changed the world. So, like, your life will never be normal ever, ever, ever again.
That's right. You know, Mick Jagger?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, just the perspective.
Although he takes it in pretty good stride. I think he gets it, but.
Well, I think Paul McCartney handles it well, too. I mean, honestly, I've thought about this one before when I was maybe a little high.
Why not?
But, you know, the idea of being that isolated from the rest of humanity, that level, that rarefied air of, I mean, something beyond celebrity, really.
The next time you pay your utility bill to beat the cutoff notice,
yeah,
that is the one thing that Paul McCartney will never understand.
Not at all. Not at all.
That's the one difference that you'll have.
Well, there's a lot of. I mean, there's a lot of those. There's a lot of those.
He probably doesn't understand what it's like to pump gas into a car.
Might not. He might not understand what it's like to go to, like, the grocery store.
I was just thinking the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, he can't. He can't walk into a Kroger without getting fucking mobbed.
No, I mean, he couldn't go, exactly. He couldn't go in and buy his favorite brand of peanut butter.
No.
Because it would be an ordeal.
Right.
Conversely, if he wanted to go see the Avengers, he couldn't.
No.
He'd have to somehow, with all of his money, find an advanced copy that could be privately screened at his home.
Well, I'm sure that's not impossible for him. But yeah, no, but you're absolutely right. You couldn't possibly live a normal life and have been a Beatle or a Rolling Stone. Well, you know.
Yeah.
Honestly, this probably is, other than Keith, that's the thing about being the background player and not being the Beatles, is if you're not Keith or Mick, you might be able to go to the mall and nobody'd recognize you.
Yeah, unless you're Bruce Kulick from Kiss, you know, nobody cares a shit, you know.
But I was saying, you probably couldn't pick Bill Ward out of a lineup right now.
What if you had a craving for some Popeye's chicken? You got to send dude out to go get
it. That's right, you have to have somebody get stuff for you. And that just further, like, isolates you from the rest of us, you know?
You get up in the morning, you come out of the shower, you go to your dresser, and you pull out your drawers, and you realize that you need new drawers.
Yeah.
And it's like, All right, I got to send somebody to JCPenney right. or to Sears.
Well, these days, I guess Amazon is probably the boon to guys like that. Before Amazon, they didn't have the opportunity to just go browse shop for anything.
Pair of shoes.
Yeah.
And I need a pair of pants.
That's crazy if you think about it.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, you got guys like Chuck Berry that were idols to guys like Paul and the Stones. That
kind of driving themselves to their own gigs.
That's right. They're still working, still trying to find a way to scrape by.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird.
It is weird. It is. It's impressive to think about.
Yeah.
Because you know there has to be that bit of island madness that sits in.
Oh, there would have to be. I mean,
with all that money that you have, you still cannot buy your freedom.
Well, it's not just. I mean, look, you're like me. You work out of your house, so you're pretty much at home all day. In some ways, it's probably not any different than being Paul McCartney, except he's probably got more options as far as what he's going to do.
Oh, he's got a shitload more options. Yeah. If I want something to eat, I have to go into the kitchen and make it.
Right. Well, yeah.
If Paul McCartney wants something to eat, he goes, "Hey, yo, give me a pork sandwich."
But I said, just working from home day in, day out, I get out every night on the weekends. But yeah, there is kind of that weird, like, am I even a part of the rest of what's going on out there? Now imagine that magnified by 1,000,
Yeah. And God help him if he ever had a hankering to go play golf. I mean, what would that be like?
Oh, I'm sure that's no problem. You don't think a British sir can find somebody to go play golf with in privacy in England? Come on.
That's a good point. They'd shut the course down. the course
he'd
for
yourself. Call up Prince Charles, hey, let's go play golf.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's just a type of life that I could not imagine.
Yeah.
I think even the royal family has a little more freedom than being that big of a rock star.
Yeah, I think so. Well, yeah, I don't know. They can't go anywhere without bodyguards,
Yeah, because it's, John Lennon, hello.
Yeah. Well, there's that, too. There's
the ever-present fear that somebody is just, Because who would want to kill John?
That's the crazy thing about living in New York, too, is just, at that height of celebrity, people know where you live.
Sign this for me.
Yeah. Imagine that.
Man, all because, was it because of Jodie Foster?
I thought that was Reagan.
That was Reagan, yeah.
That was, what's Mark David? No.
Mark David Chapman.
Was the guy that shot Lennon, but it was...
The guy that shot... Hinckley.
Hinckley, yeah.
Right.
Hinckley Jr. or something. Because he didn't... I don't think we use all three of his names because he didn't successfully kill somebody.
No.
I think in order to get three named, you've actually got to pull it off.
He was a putz.
Yeah.
He shot Reagan with a .22 in the armpit.
Yeah.
And Reagan was like, yeah, whatever. Bring it. I don't know. I mean, hey, and in this podcast, we have gone from being the dregs of music all the way up to what's like to be Paul McCartney.
Hey, that's what it's like for hopefully some of our artists, man.
We've drawn sort of a complete circle out of the whole deal. Fabulous. Here's what's coming up on the next edition from Radioland. Yeah, this is a first too for this program because now there's an extra voice
that's
sitting.
That's right.
Here.
We've got a guest here in Mr. Andy Galloway.
When Jeff told me that you were coming by, I said, he's a stormtrooper.
Not in the Nazi sense of the word.
I mean, if anybody put it on, somebody saw you in the street, hey, you're a stormtrooper.
Yeah.
But when it comes down to actually looking like one of the stormtroopers that walked off the set of the Star Wars movie, there's a lot of differences in them. And they'll hit on you or something. It's like, dude, this is an expensive costume. Get the fuck off of me.
And of course, all the drunk women are trying to grab you.
Oh yeah. We've had the night in Nashville. I had lipstick prints on my cod piece, and you had women grab you and kiss you and everywhere.
I've never had lipstick prints on my cod piece.
Damn it, man! God. You got to get a set of armor.
Radio Memphis is an internet broadcasting service provided by PirateRadioStudios.com, Memphis, Tennessee, USA.
We're up to the point now, and this is, I'm trying to do the math here, we're probably right near 10,000 subscribers to this thing.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thanks, you everybody, for listening to it and checking it out.
Absolutely, yeah. Player.fm, Stitcher Radio, who else has this? TuneIn. Has us and the radio station. You can listen to Radio Memphis on Stitcher, and it's all on one convenient app. It's sort of the iHeart for Independence.
Oh, cool.
It doesn't cost me anything to get into it. And then, of course, iTunes has
iTunes, that's where I subscribe.
So. And oddly enough, I don't even subscribe to it. Because, I probably should, but to check it out. But some great comments to me personally. They don't comment publicly on it. I don't know if they know how to.
That's because we don't have a Twitter account set up for the podcast.
Is that what that is?
That's
we need a Twitter account?
A Twitter account or an email address.
Because Podbean sets it up where you've got this whole thing. You can comment on Facebook and it rolls back.
Right.
But Facebook is such a Facebook thing. You know,
just, yeah, no. I think if you're gonna take comments on your podcast, I think the way to do it is either through email or through Twitter.
So
if you're gonna open it up, be aware there's fair. Well,
there's assholes. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't know why you have that guy Jeff on every now and then. He sucks.
Yeah, it's just like, you know,
hey. Dirty D cusses too much.
Have you heard that one yet?
You should let me on your podcast. I've got a background in podcasting.
Come on in, bitch. The podcast that is available just before this one is called, actually I haven't been titled yet, but it's about, so you have a degree in broadcasting and you want to be a broadcaster. About the whole school of broadcasting thing.
In this day and age, the first question is, why do you have a degree in broadcasting?
Yeah. No, the only people that want to get into this business are people that are really fucked up.
Well, it seems like the only people that really make all the money in this business are the ones that got the business administration degrees and not the sales and marketing degrees and all that.
That and bankers.
Yeah, yeah.
Which are one and the same, I suppose. So.
Well, I am working on having my friend Andy come in. He's going to be in next week, I think, maybe. Wednesday.
Now, who is Andy? He's
a friend of mine. We've grown up together. He has, in the last several years, gotten involved in some of these cosplay groups, and they dress up like stormtroopers or characters from Star Wars or whatever.
Oh, shit, is he part of the 501st?
He was. There's a story there that we can have him.
About.
He was part of the 501st.
Stormtrooper?
He has the whole suit of armor.
Oh, shit.
But he kind of moved past that because he wanted to get into not being limited to just Star Wars. And apparently there's politics even in that kingdom of nerdery. So,
cosplay's a huge,
it's huge,
huge,
it's huge
thing. And it's not just limited. You're right, it's not just Star Wars.
Yeah, well, you know, and I mean, they do charitable events. They go to children's hospitals.
Cosplay.
And, yeah.
And there's all sorts of stuff.
But they make a regular deal out of going to children's hospitals, going to events, going to fundraisers. I think he was actually just cast in a Vans event for Vans shoes.
Awesome.
So he's going to have some wonderful stories for us. And
I'm looking forward to that.
It should get that take on life.
We're
going
to geek out.
Yeah, totally. That's total nerdery.
Cool. So, and it's cool. So I have a third microphone for this. We'll just set it up.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm just going to get started. I'm going to lean back and just listen to all this.
Oh, no. I'm sure you're going to want to ask questions on this one.
Oh, you know it will. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that'll be a fun interview. I'm sure he's got some stories.
Awesome. Awesome. Looking forward to it. So a lot of great things that are on the way here.
Yes,
in the old podcast. And it's cool because I think after, like, was it 9-10 episodes, we finally started, you know, I've addressed a good chunk of what I've wanted to address early on.
Yeah.
In the business, in the radio business.
There's still that one thing, I think.
There's a lot of those one things, and there will always be those one things, and that will always be that way. And what will happen is from time to time I'll bounce back, but I'm wanting to expand it, and right. I swear to God, you and I are going to sit and we're going to host a podcast in a bar someplace.
Sounds like
we're going to open it up and have a big old time with that. So.
Hey, if you have your way, we'll host it from a strip club down on Beale Street.
Be a little noisy. It'll be a little noisy. Ladies, could y'all keep that down over there? You know,
coming up on the main stage, everybody give it up for Jasmine.
yeah, exactly. They're all named out of my spice rack.
Yes. It's
basil.
Basil.
Oregano's on the main stage.
Parsley, coming up next.
So, anyway, well, thanks for coming in. And
always a pleasure.
I'm looking forward to it. Because I love you come in about every 3 or 4, I think, is the way it works.
Yeah.
And it's awesome.
Let me know when you want me. We'll make it less or more often.
You know, it'll be fun nonetheless. So, once again, thanks for tuning in to being a part of the old program here. It's Rick Cheddar from Radioland, and there you have it.